Well, hello, everyone. My name is Michael Young, an insurance coverage and extra contractual lawyer in St. Louis, Missouri. And this is another episode of Tales from Insurance Land, what I'm calling the latest chapter of Tales from Insurance Land. In a prior episode, episode two, we talked about the Connecticut Supreme Court's decision in the Smedley case, which I feel was probably one of, if not the first case to really fully articulate the idea that the duty to defend in liability cases is broader than the duty to indemnify. And so to sort of bring us up to speed on that and talk about what I think is sort of an interesting nuance, we're going to have here today Laura Dowgan from the Kennedy's Law Firm. And yeah, I think this is going to be a really fun discussion. Laura, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I feel like I'm meeting a celebrity being on your podcast, and it's my first one.
Oh, no. Laura, tell for our audience that doesn't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Sure. I work out of Kennedy's New York City office. I am a New York and New Jersey insurance coverage attorney. My whole career has been in insurance coverage from even before law school. I started off my career as a paralegal at an insurance coverage law firm, and that's kind of how I ended up here. And it's interesting that we are gonna have this as a part two to the Connecticut case because I am actually sitting in Connecticut right now, so it's very fitting.
Awesome. Did you know that Connecticut may have been the first state to, articulate this rule in the fashion they did?
I had absolutely no idea. I'm surprised because we don't have too much in the way of insurance coverage law in Connecticut, but it was interesting.
Gotcha. Well, as we said, this rule that a lot of us just take for granted, this idea that the in liability cases, the duty to defend being broader than the duty to indemnify judgments or settlements. From your perspective, Laura, what does that principle mean to you?
I think sometimes in our world, some attorneys on the policyholder side, they love this principle that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. And they take it so far to mean, anytime an insured is sued, there should at least be a defense because, it's broader than the duty to indemnify. I mean, it's broad, but it can't be that broad, or nobody would ever be able to afford insurance premiums. They would go up so fast if every time an insured got sued, there was a duty to defend. So to me, it really means that if there is a reasonable possibility of coverage, if what the plaintiff is saying is true, then there's a duty to defend. And I fully understand and appreciate that part of the reason why we sell these policies or that policyholders need them is for the litigation insurance component of it. It's not just to pay judgments or settlements. Litigation is very expensive, and that's a huge benefit and a huge part of the product itself is the defense if you get sued for something that might be covered. And I understand, the risk that something might not be covered is on the insurance company, not the policyholder. So if there's a question, then there's a duty to defend. But if there's no question, then that's where, in my practice, we draw the line.
Yeah, I think sometimes those in our loyal opposition just sort of use that phrase as sort of a get out of jail free card when the argument isn't going well at the hearing sometimes.
Yes. And it's almost a sign to me of weakness in my opponent's position when I see three pages citing to this very basic principle that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. I hesitate to even say this, but I almost just skip over those paragraphs because I'm more interested in the reasonable possibility of coverage part of it. And if there is a reasonable possibility, then there absolutely is a defense, and that's what the insured paid for.
Well, and we can kind of get into that a little bit. You indicated during your intro there that you work in matters in New York and New Jersey. How does this principle play out in New York?
New York is pretty similar to the rest of the country in many ways. The courts will liberally review an underlying action to see if it's possibly covered. If one claim is even potentially covered, there's a duty to defend the entire action. And they look, you know, is there a potential for coverage? And I've seen some courts push that potential really, really far. Obviously, there can always be some gray area in the potential for coverage. I mean, I've seen courts in New York, like in a case where it was, you know, a landlord and a tenant, and the issue was, is the landlord reasonably entitled to a defense as an additional insured? And it was a slip and fall on a sidewalk and on some snow and ice. And the landlord had the exclusive duty to clear the sidewalk of snow and ice. So the tenant's insurer said, you know, no, there's no possibility of coverage here. This is a slip and fall on snow and ice, and you're responsible for the snow and ice. And the court actually read the pleading so far to say, well, what if the tenant left a hose running and the hose pooled the water and then the water froze and then they slipped and fell on it and they found the duty to defend? And that's not what happened. It's not what was alleged, but that court pushed it so, so far. And so we do see that in New York, courts liberally reading the pleading to see, is it reasonably possible that there could be coverage?
Yeah, I had a case somewhat similar to that, at least that argument in Illinois a few years ago. And the trial judge says, well, what if they said this? What if they said that? I'm like, judge, what if they said any of these things? You know,
right.
You know, how far does that go?
Right. And when I'm talking to my clients and presenting them this issue, I always say, you know, it has to be a reasonable possibility, not just a possibility if, you know, like aliens come down from Earth or come down to Earth, you know, it has to be reasonable. New York is actually, it's also interesting. We're not a strict four corners, eight corners state all of the time. The insured can always bring information from outside the pleadings to get coverage. The insurance company can't use extrinsic evidence to avoid the duty to defend unless it has nothing to do with the merits of the underlying case. So I think that that's probably, I imagine in your practice in the Midwest, probably pretty similar to the rest of the country in terms of the duty to defend.
Right, right. And I guess from the insurance company's perspective, you know, what are some issues that you see with claim handling, you know, as that principle's articulated in New York?
New York is a little bit at least unique in that I see a willingness to be a little bit more assertive in taking coverage positions, as is typical, I guess, for a stereotypical New Yorker. We can be a little bit aggressive and push positions harder. And that's
I've never seen that before, but go ahead.
Oh, I'm sure never, never. But, you know, New York, we're a little bit more protected because the bad faith standard is so incredibly high in New York that we rarely see claims of bad faith. So it's more of, it's a really good breeding ground for case law on the issue of the duty to defend because there's a little bit less fear of consequences. So we might see somebody come out and say, no, there's no reasonable possibility of coverage here, and let's litigate it and find out why. That could be. So I see that principle coming out. I also see, which is helpful for me in my practice and what I do, is that there is a need for coverage counsel involvement as an underlying action continues, because you are defending counts that are not covered or counts that might not be covered. So you need somebody out there to continue to look at the pleadings, look at the discovery as it comes in, and continue to give coverage advice as matters and issues come up, especially with our insurance law, regulation 3420, that requires a timely disclaimer. Generally, that means 30 days from when you should know that a coverage exclusion applies. So you really do have to have somebody continuing to look at coverage and flagging issues when they come up to timely deny. If that becomes appropriate.
You know, what are some issues do you see then, I guess, from, you know, the insured's defense counsel perspective that they have to deal with under this principle?
That can be a little bit tricky for my defense counterparts, because They have, obviously, the insured is their client. They have a duty of loyalty to their client, first and foremost. And they have to stay out of the coverage issues. But they also have to be careful that they're not talking their client out of coverage when they're reporting it to the insurer while right. still being truthful to the insurer. Does that come up a lot in your practice in Missouri too?
It does. You know, sometimes the debate here is, should the insurance company send the reservation of rights letter, for example, to defense counsel? And I always feel yes, even if defense counsel is not supposed to be getting entangled in coverage issues, they need to know what the fault lines are. And sometimes you can tell what they are from experience, but sometimes you can't. And if you don't know what the issues are, how do you prevent yourself from getting into trouble?
Yeah, I agree. And I always copy defense counsel on my reservation of rights letters for that issue. And also, they can sometimes use that letter as leverage in negotiations to say, you know, here, it's not covered. Here's the letter that says it. I didn't write it. I'm not the one telling you. So it can be a little bit tricky. But a lot of times, if there's a major reservation of rights, the insured will demand independent counsel. And they're entitled to that in New York, as long as the issue that we're reserving on is something defense counsel can theoretically control. So, you know, if there's a punitive damages count, there always is an entitlement to independent counsel. And then, you know, it can be a little bit harder when you have independent counsel to get that information. And again, all the more reason why you need to have your own set of eyes looking at deposition transcripts and discovery and all of that. And sometimes even up to doing your own liability evaluation, because I've had battles with independent counsel over getting that information.
Right. And for our audience who might not know, when you say independent counsel, this is a situation where the insured gets to go out and pick their own defense counsel. This isn't panel counsel selected by the insurance company.
Exactly right. And I guess the fear is a divided loyalty. And so if there's a reservation of rights, the insured can go out and pick their own counsel that they know has no, in theory at least, has no loyalty to the insurance company. Their sole loyalty is to them. And the rates have to be reasonable, of course. And there's always a battle over what that reasonable rate is.
What reasonable is, exactly.
Yes, because there are cases in New York that have held that, you know, $1,000 an hour is reasonable. And that's not unheard of in New York City to find partners billing at that rate. But it's certainly unheard of in our industry, unfortunately for you and I. But
I was going to say, I need to move if that's if that's the reasonable number.
Yes, it's certainly not for us in our realm, but I have seen those cases. And I've also seen cases that say, you know, panel counsel rate is reasonable. So there's usually a battlefront in that respect as well.
Laura, the other state you indicated that you practice a lot in terms of your coverage practice is New Jersey.
Yes.
Does New Jersey see the duty to defend versus indemnity issue the same as New York?
So in theory, yes. In practice, definitely not.
Okay. I was going to say, otherwise we're going to have to cut this short, but go ahead.
Yeah, otherwise, yes, it does. And so goodbye. Thanks for you all for joining.
That's right. Have a good night. Everyone drive home safely.
New Jersey, you know, despite being, I mean, from my office, I could basically see the New Jersey on the other side of the Hudson River. It really couldn't be more different in terms of how it plays out in New Jersey. The principle is still the same. The duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. New Jersey also permits extrinsic evidence or facts that are not alleged in the pleading. They do liberally read the complaint. But unlike New York, in New Jersey, the duty to defend only extends to the covered causes of action. And the insured is on its own for claims that are clearly not covered. So they can get their own counsel for those counts or causes of action. Or a lot of times we will work it out where we'll say, you know, there are four causes of action alleged. Two of them are not covered. Two of them are. So we'll split the defense counsel bills on that grounds. Actually, my father is a New Jersey practitioner, and he will very often get hired by his clients to represent them on the non-covered causes of action. He recently just had a case. It was a, I think it was a drunk driver, and hit someone, and the carrier appointed counsel to defend the negligence causes of action, and he was coming in on the punitive damages count. And it gets a little tricky then because you have two attorneys entering their appearances on the same lawsuit. But it
Maury,
basically New Jersey.
what you want to give your dad's name a shout out in case anyone is
Sure.
interested in that?
Mike Dowgan in Dayton, New Jersey.
Got it.
So he very often he will come in, and then I get a phone call from him asking questions. You know, well, can the company do this? Can they do this? This is what they want to do. What do you think about it? So it's an interesting perspective. I've had cases where only one claim is potentially covered, and we know it's meritless and subject to a motion to dismiss. So, you know, we'll give you counsel basically just to file this motion, and that's it. So if you can tell what's covered versus what's not, you only pay for what's covered. If you can't tell what's covered or what's not, or easily break that up, the duty to defend extends to the entire action, but the insurance company can get reimbursed at the end of the case for what was actually not covered.
Interesting.
So I
You know, because I teach this a little law school class in insurance, and I always tell the students, you know, the duty to defend being broader than the duty to indemnify. If you have, you know, a 99 count complaint and one count is covered and 98 are not, the insurance company has to defend the entire complaint, not just the covered one. That's not what New Jersey does.
No, they don't. And New Jersey will sometimes do their own thing. I think my own view of it is sometimes, you know, they're like, we're not just going to follow whatever New York does. We're our own state and we're going to do our own thing. And
Right. I
this
was going to,
is
sorry to interrupt, but I was just going to ask, what is the rationale for that? Because that does seem like a distinct minority rule.
it is a very distinct minority rule. New Jersey sees it as the insured not getting more than it paid for. They're seeing it as, yes, they're getting coverage for what is actually covered, but they didn't pay for what is not covered. And therefore, they're not entitled to even a defense for what is clearly not covered. And I think New Jersey also does it because then the burden of divided loyalties is not on the attorney. You know, there is no right to independent counsel in New Jersey, or, you know, your own counsel. Because there's no issue here. The carrier is paying for what they are going to cover, and the insured is paying their own attorney to represent them on the non-covered counts. I will say there is a tweak to this a little bit, because if you're in a situation where, say, it's not so clear, I mean, if you have one count for punitives and the rest of it's covered, it's pretty clear as to what the split is. But if, you know, coverage is going to turn on a question that has to be litigated, and there is a duty to defend under a reservation of rights. New Jersey courts have found that the insurance company is actually not permitted to control the defense in that case. So you have a reservation of rights. The insurer is not allowed to control the defense, and the duty to defend is converted into a duty to reimburse at the end of the case, which really leaves the insured in a tough spot because they basically then have to fund their own litigation costs. And if it ends up that it's covered, they get all of it back, or they get that part of it that was covered back. So to kind of fill that gap for them, as long if you issue a reservation of rights, you can control the defense as long as you give the insured the choice. So you have to have language in your reservation of rights letter that says, we will provide you a defense from dollar one, but please know that you have the right to reject our offer. And if you know, you have to say if, you know, silence will be construed as acceptance if you want them to not have to respond to you. And that's honestly, that's in the insurer's best interest, because maybe it's a big case and they don't want the insured out there hiring whoever is the cheapest that they can afford to defend this big case. So maybe they want to hire their choice of counsel to come in and do it. But you have to advise the insured, you know, you have the right to say no to our offer to defend you under these terms because we might not cover you at the end. So it's a little bit tricky. And I was shocked the first time I had a big construction defect case in New Jersey. My insured was the owner and the GC. And I was like, great, I'm finally at the top of the food chain here. I'm going to pass this to all of the folks that worked on it. And they
Right.
all said no. They all immediately said no. And I was looking at it like, I'm sorry, what? What do you mean? Like, we are potentially covered under your policy. And they cited to the, it's called the Bird Rule, BURD is the name of the case, which basically they said, yeah, we will pay for you if it turns out that it was covered at the end. So you defend yourself. We're not going to offer you even a defense in this.
Wow.
It's converted to the right to reimburse. And we had to pay for it all until the end.
Yeah, see, I'm just fascinated by this because this setup is so completely different than our experience here on my local stuff. So, from the insurance company's perspective, Laura, what are some claim handling issues that the carriers see with this New Jersey rule?
I've seen many times carriers will send out a reservation of rights letter and appoint counsel without that magic language. You have the right to reject. And if you do that, you've waived all of your coverage defenses. And you, like, if you control the defense, that's it. You own it if you're controlling it without advising the insured of their rights. So I've seen that quite a bit because
Wow.
it's unusual. It's an unusual scenario.
So if you're a New Jersey insurance company or issuing policies there and you're issuing a reservation of rights letter, call Laura to make sure that language is in there, correct?
Yes, exactly right. I've seen issues come up, and this is something that my dad has called me with in his case. It's a little bit tricky, you know, can you settle only the covered claims and just walk away and leave the insured in there to dry on the non-covered claims? And honestly, like the answer to that is most often yes. And that's what I told my dad, and he wasn't too happy with me on the dark side over
I
here.
bet, I bet, yeah.
But they did. In that case, they settled his the covered the negligence claims. They settled, and he went to trial on the punitives. And he did get a good result, so I'll shout him out again for that. But it does become a little bit, and it's a little odd. You know, it's almost like you're getting signed up for a group project with another lawyer that you didn't agree to, where now you have two attorneys that they've never worked together before, and now they're suddenly working together in the same case. They might have different strategies and different opinions. So that's certainly something that comes up
Yeah,
on the claim.
it's super interesting. And I know where this is a audio podcast and the audience can't see me, but yeah, the idea of where I am in Missouri settling cover claims and letting the insured loose on the uncovered one, it's making me sweat quite a bit. So it's probably good that we're not doing this on video. Laura, can you speak a little bit about it and maybe if you can share some of your dad's experience, what did defense counsel, the insured's defense counsel, either on the carrier side, appointed by the carrier or whatever, or, the independent on the uncovered stuff, what are some things they deal with in New Jersey under this principle?
They have to deal with, I mean, they deal with, like, they are focused on their own aspect of it, but they have to deal with, you know, at a deposition, asking questions that are in their client's best interest on their piece of it without prejudicing the other side, you know, because they do, defense counsel's number one priority is to the insured no matter what. So while they're not covering the non-covered parts and they can just walk away from it, they still have to make sure that they're not prejudicing their client when they're, you know, going through discovery and asking questions and thinking through strategy in terms of what's in the overall best interest of the client. And I've seen that. I've had cases involving medical malpractice where a hospital, you know, might be sued on the medical malpractice vicarious liability and negligent credentialing of the doctor. And that's not even independent counsel. That's just two policies, and they're only providing their their attorney for their own side of it. And they had to be, you know, careful about doing things like that. And, you know, if one attorney's not pulling their weight and they're late on discovery or they're, you know, not providing all documents, it's the client that's going to get, you know, the negative adverse inference at trial, you know, and that's just one client. And so you have to be careful, I think, when you have too many cooks in the kitchen is not always a good thing.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's like a group project that you didn't necessarily pick your partner, but here we go.
Exactly. And so that nobody ever liked that, you know?
Well, and I guess maybe sort of to sum up here a little bit, you know, what can, you know, from your experience and your view, what can we learn about this duty to defend principle by seeing really the very different ways that New York and New Jersey handle it?
Yeah, I think number one, for businesses in the New York City metro area, they need to be a little bit aware of the risks in each jurisdiction because it could be vastly different. And there are many businesses that do work in both states. I think we can certainly take from this that never to make assumptions and that the jurisdiction really does matter. I have cases, you know, where a choice of law becomes the primary issue in the dispute because one side will say one thing and the other state will say something else. So just to pay attention to what jurisdiction you're in and not make assumptions that every state follows the majority rule, even if they're similar in other respects.
Right. And I guess, too, if, you know, for those of us that follow different versions of the majority rule, that is, if one count's covered, you have to defend the whole thing. And people may or may not like that. But if you don't like that, you know, what's the alternative to that sort of deal? And it seems like maybe New Jersey and take a look at that. Like, if you don't like this, here's what they do. Do you think that's a better system?
And, you know, I see pros and cons to both. I don't know that I would say that one is better than the other. I think it's just different issues arise. There are different challenges. And I don't know that one is more efficient than the other because I see problems with both in many respects. So I don't know that one side necessarily even favors the other. You know, New York, they have to, you get a defense for the whole thing, but you know, the carrier can control it for the most part and you have those issues. In New Jersey, you can have your own person come in immediately and fight for you on the non-covered counts. You know, it's just different ways of doing things.
Got it. Well, Laura, thank you so very much for coming on what I've been calling the latest chapter of Tales from Insurance Land. If folks want to get a hold of you to talk about New York, New Jersey, or any other state besides Missouri and Illinois, how can they get a hold of you?
Sure. Definitely don't call me from Missouri or Illinois. I might get you arrested based on this comment. Sure. My email is Laura, Laura.Dowgin, Dowgin, @kennedyslaw.com.
Got it. And a phone number?
732-266-6184.
Awesome. Laura, thank you so much again for joining us today. I thought this was an amazing conversation. I've learned, this is just so different. It's just kind of blowing my mind as we speak here. So thank you again for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to have colleagues that like to be collaborative. So thank you so much.